Talk given Saturday, 11th August, 1990.
We have in our midst today Dr. Giovanni Turchi. He is a doctor of engineering, but one of his main interests is the study of the religions of the world and what mankind has contributed in that direction. He is an eminent translator from English into Italian. He himself comes from Milan, quite a famous town in so many ways. And I know you will all welcome him, and I especially would like to add my voice to that welcome. And thank him for being so gracious as to come to our meeting today. Everyone in the world is born with a natural urge for well-being and happiness. But according to the way in which we grow up and are conditioned by our parents, teachers, friends, and our whole environment, we interpret happiness in various ways. Some of them are harmless ways, and some are harmful ways. I needn't expatiate on that, because you all know what the life of mankind has been like. Now, there are a few people, and always have been a small number only, who are concerned with the after-death state. What happens to me after death? And various theories have been put forward. Doctrines of heaven and hell as rewards or consequences for good doing and evil doing. In the one case, it's the promise of heaven for those who are good is like a carrot luring the human donkey. And the fear of hell is the terror that is instilled into a person for evil doing. But neither the carrot nor the fear has really succeeded in making man virtuous, nor has it enabled him as a human race to discover the purpose of his existence and give him some vision. I won't say merely conception or idea, because conceptions and ideas come and go, but to have a true vision, a true understanding of what is really meant by human fulfillment. We have this word immortality. What is immortality? The serious-minded person, even when he's a child, asks his parents. And his parents are inclined to tell him that immortality is a state of supreme well-being and happiness, or a state of intense horror and punishment, according to the manner in which one has lived his life, forever and ever. Now you will see that this statement is couched in terms of time. If you read the descriptions in the scriptures of heaven and of hell, you will see that they are very much of the earth, earthy. The Zarathustrian scriptures are some of the oldest in the world, probably the oldest in the world, or they may be contemporary with the Judaic scriptures. Now, in the Zarathustrian scriptures, you find curious statements made about the heavenly state. You are like knights in shining armor, champions of God against the forces of evil. And the women have finely embroidered clothes to wear and lovely cushions to sit upon and so forth. Many of the Zarathustrian ideas, not so much of heaven as of hell, have been incorporated in Dante's Inferno. There you get compendious descriptions of the tortures of hell in the various circles of hell, as Dante puts them. Of course, Dante's Paradiso is a masterpiece of mystical writing, and he must have had some extraordinary vision which made him produce the Paradiso. Then in between there is the Purgatorio as such. Now, this idea of immortality as being something forever and ever is couched in terms of time. Our ordinary everyday consciousness functions in terms of time and space, of temporality and finitude. Everything that is manifested, whether it be the stars, or whether it be a tree or a human being or an insect, has a finite, definite size and has a certain time span for which it exists. Now, time and space limit our consciousness. We have seen, if we study carefully, the development of consciousness through the various kingdoms of nature. In the mineral, one wonders whether there is anything like consciousness at all. In the plant world, there are the beginnings of sensitivity, of feeling, which possibly, probably even, imply a consciousness. In the more advanced aspects of the animal world, especially the monkeys, the primates above all, consciousness is very much more developed. You know how a chimpanzee can take a crooked stick and pull down fruit for his own food. And if that stick is not long enough, he is able to tie two sticks together, curved at one end, of course, and pull down what he wants. Now, this bespeaks a considerable development of the ability of his brain to think out, as we would say, a technique for obtaining his food for existence. But in man, we find consciousness manifesting its highest development. And when I say highest development in man, here again in the human race, there are grades and grades of intensity and clarity of consciousness. We must bear this in mind carefully. The range from that kind of living which attempts to draw the so-called not-self to one's own self. I want food, I want drink, I want this, that and the other. I want to be rich, I want to be so and so, and so on and so on. But all the time, the self and the not-self are differentiated. They are separate from each other. It is this kind of isolative and separative consciousness which is at the root of practically all our illnesses, our miseries, our defeats, our pains, and some of our what we call achievements in the way of manufacture, of building bridges or houses, etc., etc. That is one end of the scale. At the other end, we have a totally different kind of consciousness. A consciousness which has enabled man to realize, and remember that the word realize means to make real the true nature of immortality. Reality and realize are words which are derived from the Latin res, genitive rei. Res, rei, meaning a thing. It is a thingified perception, so to say, of the nature of immortality. But this thingification belongs actually not to the realm of immortality, but to the realm of mortality. Because everything whatsoever, all manifestation without exception, comes into being, has its span of existence in which it proceeds, whether it be the billions of years of a cosmos or the few seconds of subatomic particles, or fractions of seconds of subatomic particles. Whether it be that, it is subject to time. In other words, to mortality. Everything is subject to mortality. All manifestation. That doesn't mean that what we call the unmanifest is necessarily to be equated with the immortal. Mortality means death. As Jesus said, the prince of this world cometh, the Lord of death. And the prince of this world is Lord of the entire manifested universe. There is birth, there is procedure, there is death. And it is what happens, man asks, wants to know, what happens to me after death? And he desires an immortality of bliss after death. That's his desire. But he doesn't know that this desire implies that the context in which his consciousness functions can never be the context of space and time, of finitude and temporality, but it has to be the context of the infinite and the eternal. We use those words, infinity and eternity, quite easily, quite glibly, without appreciating to any worthwhile extent their real significance. For instance, in terms of time, we have a beginning, proceeding, ending. In terms of time, we have a before, a present, and after. But in terms of eternity, there is no before, there is no after. There is only what the great mystics have called the eternal now. There is that which I have liked to call only immediacy. There is a permanent immediacy where eternity is concerned. Where infinity is concerned, there is no such thing as measurement or weight, nothing to do with our ordinary criteria which depend upon measuring length, breadth, anything at all. So now, this context of infinity and eternity is the context of the immortal. All our thinking in the ordinary way, and even with flashes of genius, is expressed in a system of words, that is, expressed through language. Language was invented to signify that which our senses conveyed to the brain, and the brain's business has been to integrate. It's not so much integration as trying to make into one what cannot be made into one. But the reality of the oneness can enter even the functioning of the brain, which is the instrument of mind. It is not the same as the mind. It can affect the brain sufficiently to bring about what we call thoughts or insights or feelings, which are again expressed in language. But every single word of every single language in the world has a limited meaning. It is confined to the finite and the temporal. We may take a word like when we want to express the transcendent, we may take a word like God or Ahura Mazda or Brahman or whatever word you please. But that word is conceived of by the average ordinary human being in terms of a person. So the personal God is invented. But this is an invention by man, which has misled man very considerably. I would say that the word God and its misinterpretation is the root source of our self-esteem, our self-concern, and our belief in ourselves as particular, separate, immortal beings. Immortal in terms of a postulated soul or spirit and so on. All of which don't stand the test of clear vision. And by clear vision, I do not mean an activity of the brain in terms of language, but a state of being which is wordless, which is silent, which is ineffable, which is utterly peaceful, and so peaceful that the whole organism experiences that state of bliss, which is really the state of immortality. Because if we look at our thought process, a thought arises, it expends itself in some way or other, and then it passes out and is chased by another thought. And it's the same with all our actions in life. There is a beginning, a proceeding, and an ending. But as and when there is a stopping of this process of discursive thinking and of sequential action, then there emerges a state of consciousness which is not a knowing in terms which are capable of description, but which are wordless, which are thoughtless, carefree, and deathless. This is the point. Because when the brain stops talking, you will tell me, why don't you stop talking? When the brain actually does stop talking, in what, and you are awake, fully awake, in what manner are you conscious? Our ordinary consciousness is in terms of mortality, beginning, proceeding, ending, birth, death, and so forth. That's our ordinary consciousness. But when that stops, and you are fully awake, in what manner are you conscious? Now you are no longer conscious in the mode of mortality, but in the mode of the deathless, the immortal, which has no words, no shapes, no manifestation involved in it. You can't stop the flow of discursive thought by some preconceived means or techniques. It stops naturally. It is like a going to sleep, in a sense. But it is the sleep which is the immortal awakening. It is impossible to describe. It is, as in Sanskrit it is said, achintya. It's thoughtless. Thoughtless means wordless, and wordless means also non-manifesting. All manifestation begins and dies. So that here and now you can experience the actuality, the reality of immortality as and when the discursive thought process comes to its natural ending. How does it come to its natural ending is the question. How can I bring about this natural ending? I cannot bring about this natural ending. It comes about by itself. This is one meaning of the term the grace of God, or the grace of transcendence. It happens to the single organism in which, of course, the whole of God, the whole of infinity, and the whole of eternity, all of immortality is embodied. It is there. We have to let it come to life by becoming free of our normal pursuits, our desires, and so forth. This is why desirelessness is stressed so much in all the great religious disciplines of the world, without exception. When this happens, you will find that your consciousness, which I have termed a holistic consciousness, supervenes. It is not achieved, it is not attained by me. It happens through me because transcendence itself has realized its own transcendence through the living organism, which of course has come into being through the creative action of transcendence. And this kind of creative action is what I have constantly called creative action in eternity. You take the Lord's Prayer, for example. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven. This organism is earth. Heaven is the ultimate absolute totality itself, its transcendence itself, its the infinite eternal itself. Now, thy will is thy creative action in eternity. That is the will of transcendence. It isn't something, it has no relationship to our will or our desire or passion or whatever it is. But when we can understand ourselves sufficiently deeply so that all impurity is erased out of our consciousness, out of the psyche, then the purified psyche, the purified psychophysical organism as a whole, is the living representation in the world of transcendence itself. That is why mankind has quite rightly, but without knowing that it has quite rightly, worshipped the founders of the religions as God himself or herself. Don't forget that, because there are still tribes in India, by the Malabar coast, for example, and in parts of Assam, where God is a Mrs., not a Mr. And that is all to the good. The very term Yahweh, Jehovah, is a dual term, Yod He, Vav He. Vav is the copulative, term which joins the two aspects together, the male and the female, the positive and the negative. And so, what we have to do is to let ourselves be released by transcendence itself into transcendence. And therefore, one experiences immortality in actuality here and now. There is no such thing as an immortal heaven or an immortal hell. Because, consider carefully, what is there in the entire cosmos which so manifests, so lives, that being, that although it is limited, constrained, can manifest and live in such a manner that it produces an unlimited consequence. I can't do anything at all which can produce an unlimited consequence. Therefore, an eternal heaven or an eternal hell is the work of little-minded people. It's utterly nonsensical, and it is really harmful, because it uses this terrible element of fear to try to constrain people to be good. The living of the pure life is the only way. And what is the pure life? This is something which the scriptures have put out in terms of what we commonly call the virtues. The virtues cannot be acquired. They cannot be attained. You have to let them emerge naturally and spontaneously by seeing what is unvirtuous. You can see what is unvirtuous by observing carefully that which causes pain, misery, sorrow, disturbance, and so forth. Watch that carefully. Watch it carefully in oneself, watch it in others, and watch it without passing judgments, criticizing against and reacting against what we commonly call evil, and being on the side of what we commonly call good. What we call evil is what hurts us, what we dislike, what we do not desire. If, for example, in an examination room, the test paper which is set has questions which A can answer and obtain good marks, he'll say it was a good paper. And if the questions are such that he cannot answer, he will say it was a bad paper, and so forth, won't he? Our good and bad is limited by us ourselves. So we must be very careful about such things. learn to observe without reacting for or against anything whatsoever. Just at present in the world, we have this Iraqi Kuwait business going on, and we tend to react against Sadat Hussein and so forth. But reacting against him brings about no special fortunate result, because he is somewhat impervious to my reactions. I can't do anything about it as such. And I must learn, therefore, not to react. I must learn to be quiet within myself and just observe and see if my observation will lead to some sort of picture of a happier, peaceful, loving, truthful, beautiful state. Because that force which emanates from me along those lines will be a force which tends to make whole, to heal, to purify that which is impure and ill. These are difficult things. These are very difficult things indeed. But nothing which is beautiful, nothing which is really good, can come into being without difficulty. Can I, for example, write a beautiful sonnet? I can't do it. Or write the Ninth Symphony or the B minor Mass of Bach? I can't do those things. We must realize we must see clearly for ourselves our limitations, accept our limitations, watch them carefully, watch them, just watch them lovingly, and they will transform by themselves. This is extremely difficult to see or to believe at all. But if you have a parent who is really wise and understanding, and you as a child do something wrong, something harmful or hurtful and so forth, how does your parent treat you? If he is wise, a wise parent, he treats you with kindness, with understanding. He sees the elements in you which have produced that action and helps you to see for yourself how it happened. When you see for yourself how something evil happens, then that evil becomes transformed into good. Because the evil is my own psychophysical energy. And I can't compel it one way or the other. I can only let it get transformed by understanding, by love. Because love, understanding, is the great healer. Thank you.